and welcome to House of Comments. My name's Emma Burnell. I'm a political journalist, and I am joined by a very knackered Nick Dennis, who is a Tory council candidate running in what will be today's elections when you hear this podcast, if you hear it immediately. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Emma.
And we also have not so knackered Mark, who's joining us from the West Country. How are you, non-London elite?
Yeah, I am quite knackered, actually. But, you know, I've not been pounding the streets like Nick, so I probably don't deserve to be. I've just got a bit of a cold, so.
Yeah, no, that definitely doesn't. Man flu does not count.
It's not man flu. It's a cold.
Well, at least you accept that it is a cold. Okay, so on that note, I think our first story is health related. Mark, you particularly wanted to talk about this, but I think we've probably all got some quite strong feelings. We wanted to talk about the case of poor Alfie Evans, who was a very young child who had a degenerative, incurable disease. And was cared for at the Alderhay Children's Hospital in Liverpool, which is a specialist hospital, who finally got to the point where there was nothing more they could do for him and wanted to take him off life support, stop treating him, because it was felt by them as experts to be the least cruel thing to do. Now, there were a lot of protests around this, some led by Alfie's parents, in particular his father, but also, you know, social media being what it is, people being what they are, there was a lot of heat and noise around this case. At the heart of it is a heartbroken family. I think that needs to be remembered and understood. But there is a lot of anger on both sides of that case that some feel has been manipulated and abused by third parties. Mark, your thoughts?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that I have, you know, huge amounts of sympathy for Alfie's family, for his parents. And, you know, it is absolutely awful what they've gone through. I mean, my perspective on this sort of story is filtered through the prism of the fact that I have experienced something similar to what Alfie's parents have gone through and are continuing to go through and will go through for the rest of their lives. My first son, Ollie, was born in 2011, and he had lots of congenital problems. We didn't really know at first, but they became apparent fairly quickly, and he ended up in hospital for a very long time. We did eventually get him home, but he kept having respiratory collapses and he kept having to go back to hospital. And basically every time he had a serious respiratory collapse, things got worse and he would need higher and higher levels of intervention. And the doctors did actually think that he would survive and he would grow and he would actually do okay in the end. But actually what happened was when he was just over 9.5 months old, he had a very, very severe collapse and he just never recovered from it. And we were in the position where we had been told once he'd been taken from our local hospital via a travel team and who tried to keep him alive and then in an ambulance and then got taken to Southampton General Hospital. And they put him on the oscillating ventilator, which is the highest level of ventilation. And they could see his oxygen saturation levels were like 32 or something, very, very, very low. And I knew at that point that brain damage was inevitable. And he'd obviously been saturated at that level for a very long time. And we got taken into a side room by the doctor, the consultant. And he told us that Ollie was telling us, his body was telling us that he'd had enough. And that really what needed to happen now was us to prepare ourselves and for him to be taken off the life support and allow him to pass away. And it was obviously an awful situation for us to be in, and it was absolutely heartbreaking, and the repercussions of what happened on that day we still feel now, and we will still feel for the rest of our lives. So I do to some extent understand what Alfie's parents are going through. Obviously, you know, their individual circumstances I don't really know much about, and you know, I can't put myself in their shoes. But what I find very frustrating about this situation is the other people who seem to have waded into this, who you know, in I think in lots of cases didn't have anything directly to do with the case, but have decided that they want to shout and scream and wave banners and storm the hospital and threaten the hospital staff, when all the hospital staff and the doctors are trying to do is what's in Alfie's best interests. You know, they had concluded, and it had gone through a very long process, a legal process, where everything had been considered. And in the end, the best judgment of the people involved, the doctors and the legal professionals and the judges, was that it was in Alfie's best interests for him to be taken off life support. And that is what's paramount in this situation. It was in Ollie's best interests for him to be taken off life support, and he passed away. And it was in Alfie's best interest to be taken off life support. And I don't think that it is right for people who are kind of outside of what's going on to feel like they need to get involved in such a kind of aggressive and, you know, vitriolic way. I mean, threatening hospital staff, threatening doctors, you know, some of them have had death threats. I mean, this is not right. And I don't really understand what's happened in our society in the last few years. I mean, maybe it was always a bit like this, but it really feels like it's got to the point now in our society where people just think threatening other people, you know, threatening them with murder, threatening them with rape and God knows what else on social media and in real life is just somehow okay if you feel strongly enough about something. And I'm afraid that, you know, there are processes that we have in this country that we go through. You know, we do in the end, in lots of situations like this, need to trust experts. You know, doctors aren't just going to want to whim, say, let's turn life support off for this child. They're not going to do that lightly. And I think everyone who's been involved from the, I'm not talking about Alfie's parents here, because obviously they, you know, they have their own path to walk on this and their own way of grieving. But, you know, the other people who've kind of just got involved here, I really think they need to take a look at themselves and think, you know, when you get to the point where you're storming a children's hospital and threatening people, you must have to take a few steps back and think, am I in the right here? Am I in the right anymore? And I'm afraid I can't really see how they are.
I don't have much to add really to what Mark has said, because instinctively I would have said something similar, but with, you know, from a lot more detached perspective. So it's you know, obviously it's you know, obviously to hear Mark talking about it in this way as somebody who completely understands what's happening is very humbling. I mean, one thing I would sort of throw in there is a lot of these people, I imagine, were being very righteous and were believing that they were doing something good in a really twisted type of way. And I think that's what's actually quite scary, is that, you know, to extrapolate this to the sort of bigger point about, you know, how people operate, it's almost like the ends justifies the means nowadays in many different ways on different levels. And, you know, these people who are doing these, you know, who basically inflaming the situation, keeping it going longer than maybe it could have done, and obviously you know, attacking members of staff, were you know, within them they believed they were doing good and the right thing. And that is such you know, the wrong way of looking at it. And I, you know, there seems to be a lot of that sort of from behavior, from sort of you know, bullying people on social media, you know, for the right cause, to behaviors like this, to obviously the most extreme behaviors, which is you know, terrorist atrocities. There seems to be a sort of self-righteousness that we can actually behave in what is a completely despicable way to people, you know, we disagree with, if we are right. And I think that's a very, very dangerous sort of strain that's in our sort of culture at the moment.
I think there is another aspect to this as well, which I didn't actually read the article, but I saw a link to it. And I saw, I think it was Mick Wright on Twitter, linked to an article by Fraser Nelson. And I think Fraser in the article was arguing that we should have an Alfie's law to give parents more rights in situations like this. And I think that's a very dangerous path to be going down, because parents don't own their children. The custodians of the lives of their children. And obviously the vast majority of parents want what's best for their own children. But the idea that parents should be able to override the wishes of doctors, I think, because they disagree. And obviously, you know, parents are going to be very, very emotional in situations like that. And, you know, I suppose it's possible in the situation we were in with Ollie, we might have disagreed, but then there would have been a due process to go through and there probably would have been courts involved and all the rest of it. And we would have had to go down that road. We didn't, but I suppose we could have done. But the idea that somehow there should be some kind of legal block to say, well, actually, no, the parents have a veto and they have a right to basically do whatever they want with their own child if they want to decide to continue medical treatment or take them out of the country and go somewhere else. I think we're on very dangerous ground there, because you're starting to get to the point where it's almost like the child is the parent's property and the parents can just decide what to do regardless of what any of the professionals think. And I'm really uncomfortable with that idea. I think we have these due processes in place and we have the courts and we have medical professionals to help decide what's best for the child. The child is an independent person. And I think it would be wrong to be going down a road like that.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Mark, completely.
And I think it is the child's rights are paramount. And while the parent's pain may feel paramount, it's actually the child's pain. The child is the doctor's patient. And that is who the doctor has to treat. And, you know, this can happen in lots of different circumstances. For example, the children of Jehovah's Witnesses who need blood transfusions has been a huge controversy in the past. Or organ donations. You know, parents fighting to allow their children to die, in this case, in order to preserve their religious beliefs. And in that case, again, you know, the right of the child trumps the right of the parent. And one of the things that has been most disheartening, we've talked about the sort of baying mobs, and we've talked about people like Fraser, who's written a piece, I think is misguided about sort of calling for more rights for parents. But I think there's a third category of people who've got involved here, and it's the charlatans again. I mean, not the really cool 90s band, obviously.
What are they getting involved for?
I mean, Nigel Farage has been touring the TV studios of America calling this death panels. And it's an absolute disgrace that, you know, people like that are unchallenged.
Emma, do you remember the word that you used to describe Toby Young on this podcast a few years ago? Because I think that word applies to Nigel Farage now.
I put it on Mark, but you just beat me again.
Well, actually, I think Nigel Farage is a true charlatan in the actual truest meaning of the word. I mean, I thought that when he called for a second referendum purely because his own bank balance didn't look so healthy. He's obviously you're right, despicable human being. If that's how he's making money, by going around on TV shows fanning things like this in order to improve his bank balance. Disgrace.
But I think what most frustrates me about that, I mean, you see Farage saying that, and I saw it was Mike Huckabee, wasn't it, an American senator who's actually the father of the White House press spokesperson at the moment. He also tweeted something along the lines of death panels in the UK, the government deciding life and death decisions, the state deciding. And I mean, first of all, it's despicable to be politicising the death of a child like this, of course. That kind of goes without saying. But also, it's absolute bollocks. That is not what happens in this country, of course. It's the medical professionals, it's the due process, it's the legal system. It's not the government or the state deciding what should happen in these circumstances. You know, makes it sound like Theresa May has ticked the box somewhere and decided that a child must die. It's just absolute nonsense. And of course, in America, you actually do have death panels, and they are the boards of the insurance companies that are making the decisions about who does and doesn't get cover. You know, in America, you really can die because you don't have the right insurance. And the idea that somehow our system is terrible and the American system is brilliant is like so just completely the opposite way around. I don't even really know where to begin. And the idea that Nigel Farage is swanning around making money, being paid to give these views, that he knows it's nonsense. He knows it's absolute nonsense.
He does.
It's not.
Which is why he's a charlatan.
He's misguided. He's just lying.
One minute he's promising £350,000 to the NHS, grand a week to the NHS. The next
pounds.
Week he's off in the market putting it down. Sorry, £1 million, yeah. It probably could spare £350,000 a week. But yes, yeah, it's political charlatanism. And I think that what we need now, and yeah, this may well bring us on to our next topic, we need better ways of challenging the system, because the system is so broken, that people like Farage can just play it. They're just playing us all for fools. And because we don't have the tools to stop that happening, we are being allowed to be played for fools. I'm going to move it on to the next topic, which I think is an interesting example of where the system looked like it might fail for a while, and arguably still is, which is the resignation of Amber Rudd as Home Secretary. It took about 10 days for that resignation to actually happen. And it took, there were several points at which it was clear that she had messed up, and then messed up knowingly, and then messed up again knowingly, and then covered up the mess up, and then covered up the cover up. And I think it was the cover up of the cover up of the cover up that finally got her the letter that The Guardian found between her and Theresa May, talking about the targets that she'd first denied existed, then denied knowing about existing. Then it came out that she'd written to Theresa May about them. So she did in the end resign. But there's no mechanism that said she had to. There was no mechanism that says Theresa May has to get rid of her, would have had to sack her, other than public pressure. And if you are charlatan enough, we all know that you can ride out public pressure, can't you, Foreign Secretary? So is the system working? Yeah, we can talk about, should Amber Rudd have been the one to go? Should it have been Theresa May? They were her targets. What's Sajid Javid going to be like? But I think the bigger question is, this is once again, our Queensbury rules just don't work in the 21st century. Nick?
I suppose what caught Amber Rudd out was actually, I think, more sloppiness than a cover-up. It was essentially a Secretary of State who wasn't on top of her brief and wasn't on top of her department. And, we can speculate for why that might have been the case. Was it because, essentially, she, in order to get that job, she promised to basically continue as Theresa May had operated? And obviously almost 90% of the cabinet, I'm sure, think Theresa May's attitude and policy towards immigration just doesn't make any sense. I just don't understand what Theresa May's policy and attitude to immigration is beyond she believes it appeals to a certain group of people, which I don't think it even does, because no matter who you are, most British people believe in dignity and fairness, and obviously illegal immigration is an issue, and people aren't happy with mass migration for different reasons, but actually doesn't mean that they want people to be treated without dignity. It's something that I think we value very much in this country. But I think what really did her in was the fact that she just wasn't interested enough in her department to know what was going on. So when she was asked questions, she answered them wrongly. And when she was exposed for that, she had to go. I think actually the system sort of worked in a way, because she did go in the end. And yes, it took a bunch of pressure in 10 days, which is nothing in life really for her to go. I mean, the problem, there are massive problems these are for other issues. I suppose this is why I'm conservative. I'm suspicious of bringing in hard and fast rules on things like this, because, there's always ways of getting around rules. And actually, the fact that Amanda Rudd has gone, I think, shows that in this sense, the system worked in the end, because she needed to resign.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that there is a bigger failing, both in terms of the immigration policy. I mean, just the last couple of days, it's come out that we're turning down desperately needed doctors. because Theresa May just will not be budged from this very constrictive interpretation of what the immigration rules should be. And I mean, it felt like this could have been a moment to have a more grown-up conversation about that. And we just haven't. We've just moved on. Today, as we record this, the Conservatives have voted down, were whipped to vote down, a motion asking for transparency into the Windrush case and what had happened and what had gone wrong and why it happened. You know, it just doesn't seem to be this sense that we can use this moment to pause and reset and rethink. Instead, Theresa May's gone back to her corner. The cabinet members who apparently were asking her to change have not managed to change her at all. There's lots of hope that Sajid Javid may be able to change things, but as long as Theresa May's prime minister, I just don't see that happening. Mark?
Well, I'm not sure because Theresa, sorry, I'll let Mark come in, but Theresa May has no power, really. So I think Sajid Javid will change things, but anyway. Sorry, Mark, I cut in on you.
Well, I hope you're right. I genuinely hope you're right. I would like to see Sajid Javid make a success of changing things. You know, even though he's a Tory, I'd like him to succeed in doing that because it is a desperate place at the moment. And we are desperately bad in terms of the way that we're dealing with immigration. There's so many things wrong. I mean, just take, for example, counting students in the numbers. It just makes no sense. It is literally the Wookiee defence. It makes no sense. You know, but Theresa May, even though everybody has told her it makes no sense, everyone around her cabinet table, from left to right, it makes no sense. She will not be budged. And I really hope I'm wrong, but until she is budged, I'm not sure that Sajid Javid is going to be able to change those targets because in the end, she is the prime minister. She may be a fairly weak one, but she is the prime minister. Mark?
I think Sajid Javid is in a pretty uniquely powerful position right now because he has come in, and he has come in because of a scandal that has ultimately undone Amber Rudd about immigration and about specifically how a group of, you know, immigrants and also kind of relatives of those immigrants that have been here for many years and are widely respected, even by newspapers like The Express and The Mail. I mean, that demonstrates just how wrong-headed the government has been on this. When, you know, when you've got The Guardian agreeing with The Mail, you must understand that you've made a kind of fundamental error. And I think he is in a very powerful position because what is Theresa May going to do if he decides now to implement some policies that are going to start to reverse all of this stuff? What's she going to do? Yes, she could sack him, but that's a nuclear option. She's already lost one Home Secretary. If she loses another one very quickly, she starts to put herself in an incredibly vulnerable position. And maybe she would do it anyway, but I think she'd be very foolhardy to do that. And I think looking at his speech in the Commons only a few hours after he was appointed, I think he knows that he's in a powerful position because he's already starting to talk about how things are going to be different and how the tone and the language that's used in the Home Office. Now, it's trying to turn around an oil tanker, isn't it? Actually trying to change the culture of the Home Office that's been built up over many years is going to be a very, very difficult thing to do, and he may well not succeed. But I think he's going to be given the political space to try because I don't really see how Theresa May can do anything other than allow him to. And I think the fact that she's appointed someone who himself is the son of an immigrant, I think it's good optics. Yeah. On the part of the government, but also I think that also gives him more political strength because, you know, he said himself in his speech, you know, he was talking about that, and he was talking about how you know, he thinks it's really bad how these people have been treated, and he's talking from a position of, you know, having been the son of an immigrant himself. So I think that's important. Just to go back to your broader point though, Emma, I'm not sure I'm equivocal on this. I mean, I think back to Jeremy Hunt. I remember when all that stuff blew up a few years ago when he was Culture Secretary, about the Murdoch deal and about how he'd been too close to Murdoch. And in the end, it was his special advisor that got it, and Hunt got away with it, and Hunt was then promoted, and he's still in the cabinet now. He's still Health Secretary. And I felt at that point something was broken Something was very wrong. He shouldn't have been able to survive that, but he did. And I don't think that that's, you know, giving politics and politicians the wriggle room for, you know, the kind of the right decision to be made against the headwinds of a media onslaught. I think that was despicable that he was able to stay on and that he still survived and thriving as a cabinet minister. However, since the election, Michael Fallon has resigned, Damien Green has resigned, Priti Patel has resigned, and now Amber Rudd has resigned. So the mechanisms do still seem to be working to a reasonable extent. They don't always work. Some of the levers aren't quite working properly and maybe aren't quite attached to the right things. But there still does seem to be at least the vestiges of the old, thing about politicians resigning, either because there's a scandal or because they've done something wrong or, because they're not on top of their brief. It's just that it doesn't always seem to apply. It seems a little bit haphazard. And I wouldn't have been surprised if Amber Rudd had survived this. I think if the news agenda had somehow moved on, I think if there hadn't been the dogged reporting on this, I think she probably would have got away with it. But I think there was just so much and it just built up to the point where actually it kind of did become impossible for her to carry on because of the way she'd handle it and because of the way it became clear that she had lied to MPs. I think if she hadn't have specifically done that, I think if instead in front of the committee, she'd handled it slightly differently and maybe equivocated over that question so that she then couldn't have been accused of lying, she probably could and would have got away with it.
I mean, I don't think she lied, by the way. I think she genuinely wasn't on top of her brief. Well, no, I think she genuinely, I mean, she wasn't on top of her brief, I think, which was worthy of resignation. I mean, I don't know, maybe we're quibbling over stuff, but I don't think she lied. I think she genuinely actually was not aware of certain things that were going on because I wonder how much her heart was actually in doing those things. And again, that's a, you know, that's, I'm not, I agree she could completely should have resigned. And I think, we obviously had the, we had the birth of the royal baby and we had other things going on. So, the news agenda was pretty chocker and it still sort of went to her resignation. I mean, of course, the interesting thing, obviously, is with Sajid Javid is that Theresa May and Sajid Javid do not get on at all. And he has challenged her in the past and disagreed with her on things. And it's very well known that the Tories would have got their amazing majority in 2017, she would have sacked him along with Philip Hammond and possibly Boris Johnson. So the fact that, everything that's happened shows you how much power she has, which is basically almost zilch. So, so already they're, Theresa May and Sajid Javid are talking differently about immigration. I mean, Theresa May on the day that Sajid Javid took over still basically backed up hostile environment. Sajid Javid, first thing when he came in, said, that is language I'll never use. So already there are differences.
Just to clarify, Nick, when I said lied or, misled, what I'm really getting at is, okay, I think maybe on the pure semantics, I'm willing to accept that Amber Rudd didn't specifically know about those specific targets. But the idea that she didn't know that there was a culture within the Home Office of that sort of thing is risible. And therefore, I think she should have been much more careful about what she did and didn't deny in front of MPs, because denying things that it's pretty plausible to expect you'll probably find are true, when she unequivocally denied it, was pretty foolhardy. And she should probably have done the classic, yes minister, of not really answering the question properly and equivocating, and then she probably could have survived it. That's what I was getting at.
Wittingly or unwittingly, instead of saying I don't know, she told an untruth.
Yeah.
She may not have known it was an untruth, but she asserted it rather than simply saying I don't know the answer to that question. So you can call it a lie, you can call it telling an untruth, but she didn't need to go there. And that was the weirdest part of this.
A bit of creative obfuscation was called for, I think.
Hi, I'm Emma Burnell, a political journalist.
Hi, I'm Steve Fielding. I'm Professor of Political History at the University of Nottingham.
And together, we do a monthly podcast called The Zeitgeist Tapes,
during which we talk about a film, TV show, anything to do with culture and its political implications.
We hope you'll enjoy it. Please do look for us on iTunes as The Zeitgeist Tapes. And if you do enjoy it, don't forget to rate and review. Right. So I'm going to move us on to our last topic, well, sort of last topic of the night, which is we may not all be going to die. Yay!
Yay!
There has been a quite astonishing entente cordiale between North and South Korea. There have been handshakes and document signings, and there is going to be a meeting between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-il. So, should we all be eating our words? Is Donald Trump the greatest statesman that ever lived?
I certainly think he's the biggest, best, most beautiful president that's ever existed in the whole entire world, and he is definitely the best president ever of the world.
He's also the healthiest.
Thank you, Nick. Mark, are you equally enthusiastic about our cheesy poofer overlord?
I don't think there's ever been a politician in my lifetime who has been elevated to high office that I have detested as much as Donald Trump. I despise him and I despise everything that he stands for. However, I think what's actually happened, I'm sure by accident, not by design, is that because of him and because of his ways, I think it has actually led to this situation. I don't think that North Korea and South Korea would be talking the way they are if it wasn't for the fact that Donald Trump is in the White House, because he's basically a nutter. He's a madman. And they don't know what he's going to do. And therefore, I think they've realised that they better try and do something to shore things up at their end, because God knows what he's going to do. Like I say, I don't think it's deliberate. Yeah, I think he will try and claim it's him, you know, that it's his statesman, you know, it's his statesmanship or statecraft or whatever it is he would try. He probably wouldn't use those words. He'd use his own words, followed by loads of exclamation marks. But I do think accidentally it has led to this situation. That doesn't mean I think that Donald Trump has done a good thing here. I don't. I think he's just stumbled upon it. You know, it's like a stopped clock, isn't it? Right, a couple of times a day. And it just so happens that there's been a confluence of stuff that's all come together and it's actually kind of led to this situation. But I really don't want Donald Trump to be president. I've said this before. I really don't want Donald Trump to be president. And I think a few times I've kind of expressed this view on Twitter. People said, oh, you don't want Mike Pence, though, because look at Pence. The difference between Donald Trump and Mike Pence is like the difference between a kind of raging inferno and like a kind of, you know, a little fire that's kind of slightly getting out of control, but you can probably still just about sort it out. It's like chalk and cheese. You know, Mike Pence is a very right-wing, nasty piece of work, but he is a conventional politician within those constraints. Donald Trump is a lunatic, and I just want him out of the White House as soon as possible, despite what has happened.
There is obviously the point that there is actually no point in solving the North-South Korea issue if you're then going to start a nuclear war with Iran, really. So you're right. I think there is a bit of a haphazard sort of foreign policy going on there, which can still maybe end in the death of all of us. But obviously something else that happened, I think, in the last couple of weeks in between the last time we were on air. Actually, is on air appropriate podcast language? I don't know. On digital? Yeah, I'll have to consult my my Wikipedia or something, I don't know. But the announcement that Donald Trump is going to be coming to the UK on a certain date, I forget which date. And I think I'd just like to sort of, you know, use this to sort of say, actually, I don't think people should protest against him coming, because ultimately, I mean, I agree with Mark that he's not the type of person I would want to be president at all in any way. But ultimately, he's the president of the USA. He's their leading statesman. And, you know, and they are one of our culturally closest allies. So, you know, he should come here. And I don't think protesting against him, I think is actually quite juvenile and pointless and stupid. So, I don't know.
Bollocks. Absolute fucking bollocks. There is no way that man, that pussy grabber, as he self-describes, should be afforded the benefit of coming here and being treated like, as you said, a statesman. Fuck.
Well, he is a statesman. He's president of the United States of America, Emma.
He has accidentally been elected to the president of the... That does not make you a statesman. It makes you a twat who got elected. We've all seen the people who got elected who do not merit the term statesman. And if there is one shining golden orange example, it is that man. and I will be up there in his face, as close as I can get, telling him what women's rights are all about. And if he cannot hear me, I will get closer and I will shout louder, because that is to make that stand. We do not normalise these people. We do not normalise.
Where were you when the Prince of Saudi Arabia came over? Where were you when the President of China came over? I mean, literally, you're going to have to be protesting three or four times a year if you're going to actually protest against every single leader of a regime who you don't like. And Donald Trump is a joke, but I'd so much rather live in America than Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's good for you as a bloke. I'm sure that that's lovely. But I, frankly, am quite happy to protest three or four times a year. That sounds like a day off.
Right? I forgot, yes, it's a Labour instinct, isn't it? So I go to Village Fates and you go and protest. So that's...
The most powerful man in the world? Well, then I'm going to tell the most powerful man in the world why he shouldn't be behaving and why he shouldn't be the most powerful man in the world. That's my democratic right. Protest is part of our democratic rights. If people come... I will happily protest the Saudis too. Do not worry. You know, I'm happily protest about human rights in China. Do not worry. But I do think it's important that we don't normalise Donald Trump. We don't say, yes, this is okay. Yes, he gets to come over here and not have the American people see how loathed he is around the world. That's my democratic right. I will be right up there doing that.
I think something that James Comey said in his interview a week or so ago was very well put, I thought, which he was asked about impeachment. And he said that he doesn't think that Donald Trump should be impeached because he thinks it's up to the American people to correct this wrong. It would be letting the American people off the hook, that it's them that need to do the deed by voting him out in, you know, three or two and a bit years time. And I agree with that, actually. I don't think it would be good if he was impeached. To be honest, if he was impeached and he got turfed out of office, I wouldn't lose any sleep over it. But I think it is going to be better if he's removed from office by the American people, because I think they need to cauterize the wound that they themselves have inflicted on themselves. From a political perspective, I think if he is impeached, there will just be the forever the cry of the alt-right and all the rest of them, that we were robbed of our president and he wasn't removed through the proper processes and blah, blah, blah. I think removed by the American people is the right way to go. And I think protests around the world, when he travels around the world, are a good thing, because they will remind people in America, you know, probably not that many people in America paying that much attention, to be fair, but some will. And some people in America will just be more and more ashamed and embarrassed as time goes on that he is their president. And that might help nudge things in the direction that I would ultimately like to see in 2020. So I do think democratic right to protest. I actually said to my wife the other day, I've never been on a political protest march, but I actually would go and protest Donald Trump. I feel that strongly about him. I probably wouldn't go and protest the other things that you said there, Nick. So maybe I'm a horrible hypocrite. But actually, I probably won't get the chance anyway because of family reasons, and I live a very long way away from London. But if I was to get the chance, I would go and do that, because I just think he's an awful, awful man. And I still can't believe that America elected him president. He is so woefully unsuited to that office.
I mean, coming back to the Korea thing and something else that you said, Nick, there is a real danger that we are about to renege on the deal we've made with Iran, which, what does that say to any deal that we might make with North Korea? How does that back up? Oh yeah, totally sign this with us. We'll totally stick to the deal until it's politically inconvenient or somebody else gets elected, or we just decide we can't be asked this morning because our Diet Coke pissed us off last night. You know, just again, it's not statesman. You know, you cannot say that that's statesmanlike behaviour. And so I just think it's a real, you know, international diplomacy is a game of three-dimensional chess. Donald Trump's just playing hungry, hungry hippos.
Yeah, he is. He's just bashing away, hoping that something will come of it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. And he's sort of trying to live up to a bunch of sound bites that he made during the campaign rally, which was on things he knew nothing about. I mean, what I think one of the things that would be really interesting about the Iran situation is if he does tear up the Iran deal, there is talk that the EU and other Western countries will continue it themselves. So that will put a really interesting sort of international, global perspective on things. So, you know, a split with America on a really big sort of international foreign policy issue, which I'm not sure has happened before. So, yes, because apparently, I know nothing about this, I just read stuff in the newspapers, but apparently Iran have stuck to the deal. So you're right, Emma. I mean, if a deal is made and they stick to the deal, then the deal should continue.
So on that, I think we should probably end now. We're getting quite close to time. But I imagine that a lot of our listeners are going to be weary foot soldiers popping on a nice, relaxing political podcast while they wait for the results to pour in for the local elections. And what kind of pundits would we be if we didn't offer them some sense of what we think is going to happen tomorrow or today as they hopefully listen to this? Mick, I assume that you believe that you will hold on to your seat in Hillingdon?
I personally will hold on to my seat because I'm in a sort of safe Conservative area. So and I will hold on to my seat because the voters, you know, appreciate the Conservative administration in Hillingdon, nothing to do with me at all. But I've been spending most of my time in the marginal area. So Hillingdon, roughly in the north, is very strongly Conservative. In the south, which is John McDonnell's seat, is very strongly Labour. And in the middle is where the battleground is. And I've been basically part of a team sort of defending a place called Ewsley, where we hold three councillors, but the third one won by 2 votes last time. And to be honest, the reception has been pretty good, I think. So I'm quite confident we will hold on, and I'm quite confident we might even increase the amount of votes we get in that seat and actually not suffer too many losses. And I think across London, actually, the Conservatives won't do as bad as people think they will do for a couple of reasons. Firstly, turnout will be low, and I think those who vote will tend to be older and more affluent because of that, and also because people will vote on local issues. Also, we've been running a very sort of strong campaign on local politics and local issues. And unlike the general election, where the Conservative campaign was appallingly negative and lacked complete credibility because, you know, our catchphrases didn't resonate with reality. I'm thinking of strong and stable here for a start. I think actually Conservatives are running a sort of lot more basic, simple campaign across London about what they do and what local services are about and what they've delivered. So put that all together, I wouldn't be surprised if we lost a few councillors, but actually kept almost all the councils that we already have.
So just on that, can I ask how the line Tory supporters get out and vote or they'll end up with the Bolsheviks in charge of your bins fits into your positive local issues campaign?
Have I said that? Have we said that in Hillingdon? That's not been on a leaflet I've delivered. We do call...
That was said today by Brandon Lewis.
Oh, well, Brandon Lewis lives in Great Yarmouth, doesn't he? So he's got nothing to do with our campaign. So, I don't know. It's a bit of colourful rhetoric. I mean, we do call our Labour opponents socialists, but nowadays they call themselves socialists, so that's okay. But, you know, local politics, Emma, is about local stuff, and Brandon Lewis has nothing to do with our campaign in Hillingdon, and nobody in Hillingdon really knows who he is. So,
Mark, do you have any national projections? What do you think is going to happen?
I mean, I think you know what I'm going to say, which is that I think if you're happy with your bin collections and you're happy with how your local council is spending your council tax money and your care services and all the other stuff that, you know, local politicians provide, and that your potholes are being filled in nicely, then I think you should probably vote for the councillors that have done that. And if you're not happy with them, vote for someone who you think will do those things correctly. Don't vote for your local councillors based upon whether you like Jeremy Corbyn or Theresa May or Vince Cable or whoever else, because that shouldn't be what local elections are about. They are always filtered through this prism. But I just don't think it's healthy in our democracy to do it like that, because it reduces local accountability. If in the end you just sweep away a load of councillors because the national government or the national party that those councillors represent is unpopular, then what are local councillors even supposed to do about that? There's not much they can do, really. So I think you should vote on local issues. And I don't really want to start making predictions or projections about what's going to happen nationally, because I don't think that's the prism through which these elections should be filtered anyway, although they will be inevitably. It's like basically kind of urinating into a tornado, saying that.
It is going to be interpreted that way. We are going to have a, was this a good night for Jeremy Corbyn? Was this a good night for Theresa May?
But it'll be a good night for both of them, Emma. Because whichever spokesperson you get on, they'll find a way to spin it. So it was a good night. We did better than expected. Our opponents were saying such and such was going to happen. But actually what's happened is that we've managed to keep, you know, Buggington Central. No one predicted that, did they?
I mean, I think there are a few councils or a few regions worth watching. London is predicted to go very strongly. Labour may win. Be interesting if they win Wandsworth, which was Thatcher's favourite council. They're bucking quite hard at that. They might win Kensington and Chelsea or Westminster. Obviously, local, very much about local issues there, all about the response to Grenfell. Then there'll be other parts of the country where Labour may fall short, and that again will be interpreted as about Corbyn, whether it is or not. So, I mean, I think it would be worth watching the trends overall rather than simply looking at a ward-by-ward breakdown. I do think local elections, in our ideal world, Mark, and I completely agree with you that local elections should be fought on a local basis and should be about local issues and local delivery. Problem is that councils are largely stymied by central government, do less than they have in the past, have less than they have in the past.
Yeah, they've got far less money now as well.
Absolutely, and I think people are really starting to feel that. Just local infrastructure has started to look shabby. Things, you know, the cuts are biting in ways that previously only hit the most vulnerable people who were very reliant on council services, but are now becoming more and more visible to everybody. So I think that may well be a sort of national trend that is about local delivery. So we may well see some sort of backlash against that.
I have to say, when we were in Hillingdon last year, though, it didn't look very shabby around there. So you're probably all right.
Yeah, indeed, I do. It's I've done well, surprisingly. Everyone's surprised I've done well, but
well done. You.
Yeah, no, I'm very very fortunate. But Hillingdon is actually a really interesting borough because it completely spans the different spectrums and because it goes, you know, it's basically from Heathrow up to the bit just below Watford on the west side of London, and it is a complete wide spectrum. So I mean, for the Conservatives, it is important on a national level actually, because the Conservative Party is still going through this type of existential crisis at the moment because of what happened in 2017. So if we do better in certain places, especially in London, than is expected, then I think people start thinking, well, actually, is this a sort of maybe a way of doing things, a way of campaigning? If we do lose Wandsworth and Westminster, then I think that would be, I think that would continue our sort of malaise really about what is the point of us and what are we going to do. So I think for us it's actually very important after the sort of real shock of the general election last year.
Okay, well, I'm going to leave it on that note. Nick, I'm sure you have to have an early morning delivery round.
Are
you doing a 5 o'clock job?
No, not 5 o'clock. No, it's more like 8 a.m. so we're okay with that. So
open by then. What are you doing?
That's all right. We've got a system, Emma. We'll talk about it in a couple of weeks' time if it's worked or not.
I don't know. You don't protest. You don't leaflet drop at 5 a.m. What are you doing in politics?
Oh, we have done, and we're doing lots of other things. So, we're not doing a knock and drop, but we are going to be doing lots of other things, Emma. Don't worry.
Okay. Well, we'll talk to you afterwards. Do let us know how it goes, your personal result on Twitter. Those who might want to follow us, I'm Emma Burnell _. Nick is Beta Politics, is that right?
Yes, yeah, we're BETA Politics, yep.
And Mark is Mark Reckons, which makes him sound like the pub bore, really, or Reckon.
we've had no electoral reform mentioned. No electoral reform mentioned, have we, Emma? Are we allowed to stop this podcast if Mark hasn't mentioned electoral reform? There were two options, both on how Trump won the election and about local politics and national politics, and Mark didn't mention electoral reform.
Yeah, I'm losing it.
You are. What's going on?
I thought I'd give our listeners a break.
What's going on? Guys, I think we're now falling apart. So do follow us on Twitter. We are also HOC Podcast. And please, if you've enjoyed this, do rate and review it on iTunes. Thank you to Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And this has been a Political Human production.